Ken Wilcox, well, to date anyway, has lived a fascinating life. He's the chairman and CEO emeritus of Silicon Valley Bank, which we all know failed spectacularly about 18 months ago. But he's also the author of a new book that's coming out in December called The China Business Conundrum, Ensure That Win-Win Doesn't Mean Western Companies Lose Twice. That is going to be a fascinating topic. We'll talk about both, but first, Ken Wilcox joins us right now. It's good to have you with us, and I should point out, you were smart enough to exit Silicon Valley Bank 3 years before it failed, right?
I'm not sure that was due to being smart enough. That was good fortune, I guess. Well, but yeah, I did formally tether my ties, sever my ties. I formally resigned altogether on the last day of 2019. And of course, Silicon Valley Bank didn't disappear until sometime in March of 2023.
Right, but it was a spectacular fall. And a lot of people, not me included, unfortunately, have never seen banks fail, and especially a big bank. I mean, there was a time in the 80s, we sat around on Fridays trying to see which one, you know, the feds were going to take over. And there were sometimes two or three every Friday. But this one really was, I didn't think a bank could fail this quickly in just a matter of hours almost. What happened?
Well, this was a totally different situation, which would not have been possible 30, 40 years before, probably not even 25 years before. What enabled it to fail so quickly was technology. The mere fact that the people who felt uncomfortable with their deposits in the bank were able to communicate that message to literally hundreds of thousands of people in a matter of seconds using social media. And that's fundamentally what happened.
You know, the day after it failed, we talked to a small business owner who was in a bus with his kids on the way to a ski lift because it was spring break. And while in transit, he withdrew all of the corporate funds, millions of dollars, out of Silicon Valley Bank and put him someplace, I think J.P. Morgan Chase, but moved it while he was in transit. So there were poor investments. I mean, the money that they invested was poorly timed, and that really was what set it up, right?
Well, that needs to be clarified because there are fundamentally two different ways of looking at this. One's correct, and the other one is actually just plain erroneous. What really happened is this. In around 2019, 2020, in that time frame, in other words, 3 or 4 years before the bank disappeared, the level of cash in most economies around the world grew enormously and unexpectedly. And there are a number of reasons for that. One obvious one would be that central banks were pouring cash into economies in order to combat the negative impact of the COVID. In any case, going back a step, our bank, Silicon Valley Bank, was very conscientious and had been for decades about making sure that we had exactly the right amount of cash, or as close to exactly as possible, in the bank. In other words, if we had, and we did in fact, in around 2019, have $40 billion worth of loans in the bank. And if we had $40 billion worth of loans in the bank, we wanted to have $50 billion worth of cash. So it was properly margined. So you had extra cash in case depositors wanted some of their cash back before the loans you'd made gotten paid off. So keep that fraction in mind. 80% of deposits would be loaned out. And then all of a sudden, starting in around 2019, all this cash came into the economy. And a lot of it found its way into the innovation space. And because we dominated the innovation space in the United States, a lot of that cash poured into our bank. So in the course of the 3 or 4 year period between 2019 and 2023, the level of cash in our bank quintupled. It went from $50 billion up to over $250 billion.
Wow.
But the level of loans stayed constant at $40 billion, largely because people didn't need to borrow. There was so much cash right. everywhere, and so much of it went into the venture capital community, and from the venture capital community into the technology companies. So they weren't borrowing any more than they had before, but they were depositing five times as much. So picture this, you're the CFO of Silicon Valley Bank, and you've got five times as much cash in the bank as you need. What do you think that CFO thinks about? Now, I wasn't there at the time, but I know what he would think about. What can I do with it? And how can I make money with it? And you know, CFOs, in my experience in banks, are always hoping to be the hero, because the lenders are the heroes. And it makes them jealous. They see all these lenders out there being praised for their good deeds. And they think to themselves, heck, I'm the CFO. I should be being praised too. So imagine that, the CFO sitting up there with all that cash, and he's trying to figure out, how can I use it to become a hero? And he did something, or you know, I can't exactly say who it was or who he was, but he did something with it that every banker learned in Banking 101 not to do. He invested that money in long-term interest-bearing investments. In other words, long-term treasuries.
10-year, 20-year, 30-year, way out, where the interest rates were higher.
Interest rates were high. And if you know something about finance, and you don't have to know that much, you know that if you invest in long-term treasuries and rates go down in the future, you're golden, because you're holding these treasuries that are earning more than everybody else's. But if you invest in long-term treasuries and rates go up,
who wants to buy it? Happened. Nobody wants to buy it.
You're in trouble. Yeah. You're in deep sneakers. And here's the issue. I can tell you, when I was CEO of that bank from 2001 until through 2010, we would not have let all that excess cash would have come into the bank.
Sure.
We would have said to our customers, congratulations on raising all that money. Here, put some with us. And then let's take the rest of it and give it to Fidelity or Federated or somebody who knows how to invest that for you, because we're lenders, we're not investors. And the CFO, by making that decision, was gambling, because nobody knows the direction of interest rates.
That's just a spectacular. And the consequences really were spectacular. But let me leap backwards, because you spent at the bank, you spent 4 years in China trying to establish some sort of an agreement, some sort of an operation with the Chinese government between Silicon Valley to try to get some innovation, more technology and that sort of thing. And you learned a lot. And that's really what the book is about. And that's what I want to talk about when you get a little closer to the book coming out. But let me just talk about it right now. Is their economy, we came back Tuesday from Labor Day, and the markets were sharply lower. And part of it was because, yet again, they're out there saying that China's demand for copper or oil or anything else is much lower than we thought, because their economy is in such rotten shape. I mean, can they fail? Is this the black swan that could undo the Chinese government?
You know, that's a question that I don't know the answer to, and neither does anybody else. But I will say one thing. For decades now, the economists in the United States, the mainstream economists, have been predicting that China is going to fail economically. And until now, and we're not even sure that that's happening right this minute, until now it hasn't happened. And the problem with the theories of our economists is, is that they're all based on Western economics.
Yeah.
And Chinese economics are totally different from Western economics for a whole variety of different reasons. But I think the main one is that the Chinese government, which is about the same as saying this Chinese Communist Party, because everybody in the government is a member of the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party has its hand on every single economic lever. There is no free market in China. And I think it's hard for us to realize that. I mean, we can know it intellectually, but it's hard to recognize it at an emotional level.
Well, if you're 4 years on the ground in China trying to do business with them like you were, I would guess it becomes a lot clearer.
Very much so. And I think that that's one of the reasons so many Western companies have had problems in China, because we don't prepare ourselves adequately.
But see, that's the conundrum here. On the one hand, you say, why would anybody do business with China? I mean, they're crooks. They steal your technology. They can't be trusted. They flatter you, and they turn around and stab you in the back. And then on the other hand, it's one of the largest economies in the world. How can you not do business with them? How do you reconcile that conundrum?
Well, part of the reason is that exactly what you said. You know, there's a guy named James McGregor. He's still out there. He's a very, very smart guy who began his career in China, I think, 40 years ago as a journalist, and then ultimately took on other positions as well. But he wrote the seminal book probably about almost 20 years ago now, called 1 Billion Customers. And what his book was saying is, look, all you Western companies, especially American companies, you are attracted to China because you think to yourselves, a billion customers? Now, of course, it would be a billion four. That's amazing. All we've got to do is get, you know, X percent, and we'll make tons of money. And so they lure themselves, actually, into taking their business to China, but they aren't prepared. They don't know what they're getting into. Most of them are smart enough to figure it out within a couple of years. Some of them stay there 4 or 5 years and still don't know what happened to them, because what happens is we all have these things I call the mental models. They're ways of interpreting the world based on prior experience. And we take those mental models to China, superimpose them on China, and then we begin seeing China or interpreting China through our own lens. And the result is that we misinterpret.
Maybe you just need to think differently from everybody else, and maybe that would explain why Elon Musk has had a modicum of success where others haven't, that he doesn't think like anybody else.
Well, that could be, but I wouldn't. The jury's still out on Elon Musk, by the way.
Yeah.
My theory is, after the years that I've spent in China, 20 some years doing business there and 4 on the ground, is that there are really only 2 kinds of Western companies in China. The ones that know they're being screwed and the ones who figured it out yet.
You have set the stage for your book, which comes out in December, The China Business Conundrum: Ensure That Win-Win Doesn't Mean Western Companies Lose Twice. I can't wait to read it. Ken Wilcox, Chairman, CEO, Emeritus of Silicon Valley Bank. We look forward to the next time. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much, David. I appreciate it.
Thanks for more of our conversation. Go to KRLD.com/CEO. I'm David Johnson, News Radio 1080 KRLD.